We're going to move into the college age group. Bernie, thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Bernie Hirschberger. Bernie has been working at Bowdoin College for the last 20 years. God bless him. He is the director of counseling and wellness programs. Prior to coming to Bowdoin, he worked as the clinical manager for 7 years at the Jackson Brook Institute outpatient program. Bernie completed a pre-doctoral internship at the University of Missouri and then worked for 4 years at Boston University. He is drawn to working with students with anxiety and perfectionism. There's none of that at Bowdoin, I'm sure. Spiritual and existential questions, sports performance, and disabilities. He approaches his clinical work from a Buddhist philosophical orientation and utilizing CBT and mindfulness interventions. I think we could all probably use some of that, Bernie. Without ado, Bernie. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Deb. We were sitting in a coffee shop about a year ago, I think talking about substance abuse treatment for young adults. And somehow we got in this discussion about ADHD, and the next thing I knew, Deb was like, yeah, I signed you up for this conference. And I'm like, okay, like, that sounds interesting. So it's an honor to be here. Thank you for having us. Genevieve is here. I'm going to introduce her in a bit. I love the concept of letting you actually talk to a real human being who's in and out of the college experience and is dealing with ADHD, and just someone who I admire a lot. So. Let's see, what else will I say? I'm going to just try to move into some, how do these, it's a thing, you can be mindful and have no idea what you're doing with technology.
And I'll be your 18-year-old. Okay, right. Just push.
Correct. I think, though, we may have to get out of here.
Mom. Let's let a real
person. I know, right. Come up here, right.
I don't know.
This is it? No?
No.
Was that it?
No.
It's
just stuck.
I think it's stuck. It worked. Is this?
This is a great moment. If you do want to stand
this isn't it, huh?
And stretch just for a little bit.
It's moving. It's moving here. There's a bunch of references. This isn't Bernie's talk.
No.
Is there a way to go back to the original menu?
Yeah, you simply escape. I don't know which one you're looking for, though.
No, I'm wondering, do we have the slides? Are they on? Where's the other folder with the slides?
That's probably, I don't know anything about Bernie.
Everything that we took off is on the desktop right now, so you can find
it. There it is. That's it. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay. There we go. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you. And you just press to the right.
Back, yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. We have great technology, folks. I appreciate your help. So go ahead and keep stretching. I'm just going to start in a little bit because I know we're kind of, we have a time frame and I'm going to try to get done. I want to leave some time for you to ask questions, particularly for Genevieve. So this is all psychologist, blah, blah, blah. I just want you to know I'm not a physician, not a neuroscientist, not an expert. I'm not sure that attention deficit is the best way to describe, I think, what's going on for people. I think this idea of delayed focusing syndrome is something I think about. Pervasive procrastination trait sort of gets at part of it. But probably my personal favorite is attention expansiveness phenomena. Because I think what it is there's a curious, wide-open attention that resists focusing on demand. So, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Can you read these? These are, if the task I must undertake is towering over me like a great big monolith, it is too big to contemplate, so I think I will go have a little look at the internet. And then this one, it keeps me from looking at my phone every 2 seconds. So why have college students not been diagnosed? In my experience, the students that come to Bowdoin are smart, they get good grades, even if they're doing their work at the very last minute. They also have a significant amount of structure in middle and high school, and I think that contains and helps them a great deal. And they have parents looking over their shoulders typically, and that keeps them on track. The curses of ADHD, procrastination, habitual pervasive underlying anxiety. You cannot underestimate the amount of anxiety that procrastination creates for people. So it's almost like walking around with this constant sense of, I am not getting to the things I need to. If I get to those things, I actually feel less anxiety. If I don't get to them, it just keeps growing. So the chronic sense of underperformance often arises because if you get a project that you're really interested in, you can like hit it out of the park. You'll get like an A+. And then the next time you come up to an assignment, you're not very motivated, it's not intrinsically rewarding, you don't really spend time on it, and you'll get a C on it. And this like kind of inequity in response in terms of performance often leaves people feeling like they're not that smart, or they're not that capable, or they're lazy, or something else. Diminished self-acceptance comes right into that. And often I notice there's a really painful guilt about what's happening. They feel like I should be doing better. People expect more of me. They get on the phone or talk to their parents, and the parents are like, why haven't you gotten to the paper that you told me about you needed to do last week? And so not only is there anxiety, but there's this like inherent guilt about not living up to what they want, they know their parents want them to do. And they've been given a lot of often privilege and opportunity, so they particularly feel bad if their parents have been putting in a lot of effort to support them and yet they're still struggling. Impulsivity in speech and actions. That happens. Overestimating one's capacity to complete tasks. I often sit with students who keep telling me, oh no, I can do this. And sometimes I want to say, honestly, I don't think anybody could do what you have now on your plate to do. So I know you're amazing and you can hyper-focus and get a lot done, but sometimes you just need to face into, and usually if we're that point in the semester, we gotta start looking at cut bait and see what we can do, like drop a class maybe, or do something else to stay at school and not just completely get buried. The last thing is adapting to a foreign culture. I think that kids who are ADHD are actually bicultural in this society. So Genevieve, I think, is going to talk a little bit about this, but it's the idea that if you have an expanse of attention and you don't want to be rushed, there are some cultures where you can live where you get to do that. But our culture tends not to be one of those places. So I sometimes talk to students when they study away, depending upon where they go, like, what was your experience like? And I think, again, you'll hear from Genevieve that in some cultures that are generally more spacious, they feel very much at ease. And they start to feel like, oh, I'm kind of aligned with a tribe that is more like me. Whereas in this culture, you know, we just have constant pressure, demands, pushing. So I was saying to Genevieve in the car way down, like, probably there are students who would do so much better at Bowdoin if they could just take 3 classes and go more in depth. But for some reason, in our infinite wisdom, we believe that you have to have 4 classes and everybody should have 4 classes. And I think that sometimes we need to loosen up that concept, particularly if a student can manage and the family can manage to do the 3 classes and just let people live in that place. This is like the dreams you have at night, like where you haven't gone to a class for the entire semester. Thank you. So this is, honey, we want you to focus. F-O-C-U-S. Focus. Got it? Are your eyelashes real? You've probably had that experience with patients of yours where you're telling them something very carefully and they look at you and they give you something very honest not related to topic, but very honest, you know. So some of the blessings of ADHD, and I think it was Lori was mentioning about her son. I love ADHD, you know, students, just love them. But there are a couple of things here. Originality of thought, creativity, able to think outside the box. Thank goodness we have these people in our society. They are going to help us solve problems and get to places that we would never get to if we just stayed in our tried and true path. Charisma, ability to advocate and sell. There were points at time I used to advise, hang out with this group of students embracing disabilities, and probably 3/4 of them were ADHD. So there were times when I would be like, they would come in and tell me what they had just gotten Bowdoin to agree to do for them. And I'd be like, what? And I was like thinking, could I pay you to negotiate a salary? You know, you would get it. I would be so happy, and I will pay you to do that for me. Fluidity, multitasking, liveliness, spunk, spontaneity, sense of humor, persistence and hard work for a cause that is important. If you have someone who is believing deeply in something, they will work exceptionally hard and make it happen. It's a great quality and strength. Areas of intellectual brilliance. One of the things I love about ADHD students is they, in general, have a very non-judging attitude. They're very, like, they're the same group of students. I don't know, this is sort of in the spontaneity category, but also one of the students had talked Bowdoin into giving him money to jump out of a plane and make a film. And of course, the three people who had agreed to do this with him no longer were willing to do it. So he comes into our Embracing Students Disability group and says, yeah, you know, I'm kind of stuck. I need some people to do this film with me. And I don't know what I'm going to do. And three students in the group raise their hands, go, oh, I'll jump out of a plane with you. And the three students, one was a young woman who had a major visual disability. And simply said, I will tell my parents once I land that I have done this. The other student had major anxiety, and interestingly for you guys, her anxiety was around needles and medical professionals, and her parents were physicians. I won't go. But so she was like, oh yeah, I have anxiety about that, but you know, jumping out of a plane doesn't seem to be too much of a worry for me. So anyway, and It just was that this group, though, was the place where anybody on campus who was looking to be accepted for who they were, I would just say, you ought to just come by and have dinner with these people and feel some love, you know, for who you are without judgment. This idea of spiritually open, I have done meditation practice with a lot of students, and I find that the ADHD students almost automatically go, you know, I'll say something like, we're going to try to put awareness into the space between thoughts. And they'll look at me and go, yeah, got that. And then we'll sit down and do a meditation, and they will be in this meditation. At some point, we're going to develop neuroscience related to what kinds of meditation work best for which brains. And this is like a Dzogchen kind of meditation that these students can do. They just do it. Like, you don't have to break it down and say, yeah, you're doing a type of wisdom-based meditation that's like Tibetan lamas do, blah, blah, blah. And they'll just be like, what? Like I'm just, in, you know, just moving into the awareness and into the space. And that ease with conceptual thought. Interest deficit disorder. Attention deficit disorder. So why does it rear its head at college? There is minimal structure in college in comparison to high school. These are all things you know. But academic schedules, once they're laid out, you might have days where you don't have classes. For some students, that's like, wow, this is amazing. I love college, you know, and I'm going to go with my friends to the beach after we've played video games for 8 hours. And, you know, it's just going to keep going. Many of the assignments are required. They're 4 to 5 weeks if you're not in the sciences. And Genevieve could speak to this. But what that means is you have to be planning as you come up to them because assignments are bigger, more complex. There's more critical thinking. It's really difficult to write a paper that you'll get past a Bowdoin professor if you've done it the night before. I mean, unless you've done something which we were talking in the car called composting. Sometimes ADHD kids are thinking not doing, but they're organizing and putting things together. So when they finally sit down to write, they actually can do a really great product. So that is one thing that's important for people to know, I think, about learning styles, is that some people work very systematically. I get my notes, I break down the outline, da da da. Other people are like thinking, not doing, and then all of a sudden they do. So it's sometimes fun to see that gift, that, but it's also challenging because all their friends are going, you haven't written anything on your paper? And again, you just feel that sense of like somehow being behind the eight ball. Lots of distractions at college, of course. No parents providing oversight. You know, there are parents that will say, would it help me to call my son and wake him up? I'm like, you are welcome to do that. He needs sleep. If anything that provides structure, I often talk to students about, you have to develop organizational scaffolding here because nobody's going to do it. Your teachers aren't, and your coaches aren't, your theater professor isn't, your parents aren't. So you got to do it yourself. Back to the point about self-advocacy that Carrie was making. In the end, what we want to do is really empower students to survive this culture that they live in and to excel in it. And so that's a lot of both self-advocacy, but also taking self-responsibility. We have to always watch that we're not like doing so much for students that we maybe give them the impression that they can't really do it themselves, because they can. And we want them to be strong, empowered people when they leave, and not somehow like, oh, we've given you so many graces. Once you go out to your job, you're just going to expect more graces, and may not be happening like that. There is sometimes this resistance to getting help, and it's just a form of sometimes embarrassment or a little bit of humiliation. Like, I don't want to ask. They know they're smart. They should be able to do it, and they often don't want to get to the people that might be able to assist them. This is, oh crap. Can you all read that in the back? Yeah, I have to watch this one. How ADHD manifests in college, somewhat similar things. I'm just gonna highlight sleep problems. We really work a lot at getting students regulated around sleep. Also the benefits of exercise in terms of grounding and helping central nervous system responses. Anxiety and depression, you probably get why that would be coming up in the midst of this. And we're also trying not just to treat anxiety and depression if there's a learning-based issue underneath that. So I don't feel like I'm doing my job well if I'm simply jumping right to the symptoms rather than going, why is this anxiety coming? Why are you feeling depressed? So we're trying to dig in. And we use neuropsych testing a lot when we feel like we have a really great student who's struggling, because we just want to get at the bottom of what's going on. And I know you guys probably have some access to that. We can talk about that later if you want. This is, I wish I could sleep, but my stupid ADHD kicks in. And well, basically, one sheep, two sheep, cow, turtle, duck. Old MacDonald had a farm, hey, Macarena. That may not only be ADHD people, in truth. So surviving, thriving. One of the things I was thinking about offering, and I really do this judiciously, but I would be so glad at times to consult if you have kids coming out of your practice with families that are wondering, how's my son or daughter going to make the transition to college? Now, I know this is probably not wise for me to do, but if you have, I do this for Bowdoin staff and faculty, but I believe in it so strongly that if you can get a good base established with a student, I know students who have left college. My nephew did not make it through college with a brilliant mind for organic chemistry, but could not write his English papers. So he's now 27 and, you know, waiting. He's a bartender, and he's a great bartender, but like, he's a smart kid who could have. So this belief that if you have a patient and a family moving towards college, they do need to think about how to help that student succeed when they get there. So counseling centers can be really helpful in this. We use neuropsych evaluations, particularly because some people need the data in front of them, but also because you get complexity with those evaluations. You can see where the psychological issues could be affecting the student, but more importantly, you see directly what the cognitive strengths and difficulties are going to be. We try to take a neuropsych evaluation and sit down with the students, with the head of our learning center, and potentially the dean, the student gets to call who they want in the space, the parents can join by phone or in person. But we want to kind of, someone mentioned the village, Deb, and yeah, we want the village around the student. And it's not just students with ADHD, but clearly that's going to make a big difference for them. Psychiatrist or medical provider, we have three part-time psychiatry folks at Bowdoin, two MDs and a nurse practitioner. We don't prescribe stimulant medication until we have established through a neuropsych testing or previous documentation that a student truly has ADHD. For a while, as you probably know, stimulant medicines used by kids all over campus are like, hey, I want the edge. I want to take a stimulant. Can I buy it from you? Can I get it from you? So we also have students sign an agreement that your medication is yours alone. You're responsible. You can't sell that. You can't give it away. An academic coach is vital if you can find one, because what you're getting with an academic coach is someone, like I just sent a student last week to a coach, and I said, so what did she tell you first? And he said, well, she said, I should probably have a planner. And I'm like, good start. Get a planner. And she said, and you should copy every one of your assignments and due dates into your planner. And he's looking at me like she's giving him like the Holy Grail. And I'm like, yes, that is also great. You should do that. So in other words, like, you need somebody breaking down the process, because again, in my experience, high schools, middle schools have enough structure that people are tweaking and telling you and reminding you. It won't happen that way at college or university. So an academic coach. You can also get people on Facebook and Skype to work with your son or daughter, so you don't have to worry about, like, if they're in the middle of Iowa and you're not sure where to get that person, they're it'd be great to develop a list of good coaches. I'm looking over at the main parent federation, like, we could work on that idea. Disability services in our campus does allow you to establish time and a half or other kinds of accommodations that you need. That's part of self-advocacy, but it's also part of leveling the playing field. There's absolutely a need for that for some students, and you want to get behind that and find out what the school or university is willing to do with that. We really talk a lot about, the idea of parents. When I go to say to a student, I think you have ADHD, I'm usually thinking, what do you think your parents would think about that? Because if you don't have parent buy-in to some degree, you can't always get that far down the road. Because if I'm talking about neuropsychological evaluation, there could be a co-payment to that that a parent needs to sign off on, obviously. So if the parents don't believe that, or they think I'm like insane for even bringing it up, then we're not going to get that far, at least in terms of moving some things along. We can still support the student, and we will, but it's super helpful to get the parents. I would say, honestly, in 40 to 50% of the time when you dig into this with parents, or you ask the student who in your family might have ADHD, there's someone there waiting, you know. So I called this student's mom, and she's a patent attorney, and I was a little bit like worried, like she's gonna like tell me I'm like an idiot. And within minutes, she was like, you know what, I think you're really right. That describes my son very, very much to a T. And later we were having a nice conversation, and I was like, do you think anybody else in your family has? And she says, yeah, I'm pretty sure I do. So, you know, it's, you know, from a genetic predisposition, you can probably guess that there's going to be some overlay there, some connection. This mind-body practice idea, you know, you can't force people into yoga meditation classes, but you can just keep putting it out there in enough of ways that, like 18 years ago, we started this whole thing at Bowdoin feeling like you could do 100 stress management workshops, one-time gigs, and you probably won't have that big of an influence. But if you start putting regular weekly classes, so we went from one yoga class, then a Tai Chi class, and now we have maybe 7 yoga classes, and we have 5 Tai Chi Qigong classes, and we have 6 or 7 meditation classes. We also have classes now taught by students, and we made that move to partly get students feeling like, oh, this is more interesting if Genevieve's teaching it versus me. And it's totally, totally true. Like, students kind of like that idea. And we have yoga teachers and we have meditation teachers, and I'm still trying to get more males so we could do broga. And I'm willing to find money to get a student to a certification at Kripalu or someplace to make that happen. Yeah, I think the other things are pretty self-explanatory. This is like, listen, Jeffrey, I know you're a clinical psychologist, but I don't have ADD. You're just incredibly boring. So maybe without further ado, I'm going to let Genevieve. Genevieve's a senior. She is a biology major. And the really cool thing is when I told her that you guys were pediatricians, she's sort of thinking like, am I going to be a researcher? Am I going to be go to medical school? And the one thing she thinks about with medical school is being a pediatrician. So I was like thinking you guys can recruit right now today. But she is an amazing student. She spent some time in Chile last year. She's going to get she has a Fulbright to go back to Chile and research, which is very impressive. And so she's, I think, fluent in Spanish, like pretty far down the road with that. Anyway, she's just going to talk, and then you can ask her questions, and I'm going to sit down and hand it over to you.
Hi, guys. So I wrote a little something this morning at breakfast, like thinking I had procrastinated and should have thought about this a lot earlier. And that's why me and Bernie talked about composting, and I've been thinking about it for a long time and excited to be here. But I wrote a little something, and I mostly would love questions because I'll have an answer, I think. So I wrote, what does ADHD mean to me? It's basically a label for a broad range of personality traits. In some ways, the label has felt confining and constricting. In others, it's helped me understand aspects of myself and tools to help me succeed. I'm a biologist, and I believe that ADHD contributes to the way I think about biology and my ability to think about how the pieces work together rather than about the separate units and processes. I was diagnosed with ADHD inattentive type during my freshman year at Bowdoin. I believe in my own experiences that ADHD is environmental. Multiple times in my life, I felt my differences dissipate. I went to a project-based charter high school called High Tech High in San Diego, where there were no textbooks, there were no formal lectures, and there was no busy work. I thrived in that environment. An environment where I was encouraged to think big and create my own timeline and my own deadlines and my own dreams. Timelines are very constraining for me. Just this week, I had 3 essays due, and I spent most of the week with a racing mind, thinking deeply about the deadlines and finding ways to overthink the assignment. I've always done this. Since I was a little girl, I loved school and studying, but I have always had to put in more time than the average student on an assignment. And yes, I do things like procrastinate, but mostly I just think more, think deeply about the assignments I'm given. It makes it harder to get things done at the rapid speed at a college like Bowdoin, but I have found ways to make it work, to not conform myself, but to navigate my time at Bowdoin, even with my disability. So I've tried many things. My accommodation is for 1.5 hours on exams. I always use every minute of my extra time, and this is imperative to my success, especially as a science major. So like, I just, like thinking about that point, I found out that I had a disability because I got to Bowdoin, I went to every class, I took notes, I tried to focus, and every exam I took, I failed. I didn't get like a B or a C, I got an F. I got like 30% on every exam. And I remember like an anxiety attack I had in my first intro to chemistry class. And our teacher had put this huge clock, like a ticking clock on the screen. And I just like was looking at the clock, and I remember like tapping my foot and looking at the clock and thinking like, oh my God, what the heck is going on? I can't think, I've studied, I can't think. And I went to the bathroom and I like looked in the mirror and was like, I can do this, and like ran back, and I like had written the answer to one question down, and he said, time's up, and I like left and I had failed. And that's when I realized that there was something like fundamentally different about the way that I think, that I have thought I couldn't succeed at Bowdoin, but anyways, I've done many things and realized I got neuropsych testing. One of my professors, I was sort of offended when he said it, but he was like, I think you have ADHD. I think you do. I talk in class always. People get very irritated by me, probably. I literally talk the whole time, and I like race notes down at every minute, and I realize that I talk in class, and I've used it as a mechanism to force my brain to engage so that I don't like shy away and go into my head, and it works very well for me. So I don't really care if people are like, I don't care if they're irritated by the way that I like navigate. I'm maybe considered annoying in class, and that's fine because it's the way that I have managed. Anyways, I get time and a half, and it's essential, imperative to my success, especially as a science major with so many exams. But that's the only accommodation that I have, and that doesn't help at all with all the free time that Bernie's talking about and all of the lack of... It's weird, because I feel like one thing I love, the free... Like, when I was in Chile, it was so imperative, the... And life-changing, the difference in culture and the difference in what time means and the lack of deadlines, the fact that someone will show up an hour late to an appointment and no one cares, everyone will show up an hour late, and that the free, like my, the weird ways that I think that are considered weird here, like, for example, talking too much in Chile was like, made me the cool gringa. I fit right in. But at Bowdoin, I can't just like be always myself. I have to find ways to adapt. And so, time management and self-care is the most important form of like medication that I like give myself. So exercise is the most important gift I give myself every day. Without it, my brain is foggy. I start my day building mastery, and exercise is better than my medication in many ways. I also practice mindfulness. Like, Bernie's taught me a lot about mindfulness, and I do love and kindness meditation, and I practice deep breathing at night to help my brain rest, and I do yoga, and I try to get a good night's sleep. And I was against the idea of medicating my ADHD originally, especially because my parents were not supportive of my diagnosis, and I thought it hurt my feelings a lot that they didn't understand it. But I think this is a huge issue, is that so many successful students are oftentimes not diagnosed but are working much harder than the average student to get a normal workload done. And I think about high school, and I did not have a social life in high school or in middle school, particularly in elementary school. I was very disciplined to get my work done, but it took me way longer than it should have. Like, in ninth grade, you should not be staying up till 2 a.m. doing homework. That's just like not normal. But that's what I was doing, and I thought that was normal because I didn't think of it like a disability, and nor do my parents do, because I think deeply about stuff. That's just the way I do it. And in high school, that was fine. But in college, it's not fine because you don't have an extra 24 hours. You have to sleep. So I don't have the time that I was able to give myself in high school. But I take Adderall every day, and it helps me clear my mind. And I know it's considered a stimulant, but let me tell you, it calms me down. It is like a depressant to me in a way, because it makes my brain, it's like all this static going on in there, and it turns it off and lets me think about one thing and then transfer and think about something else and then think about something else. And so it's not really like a stimulant to me. But there are many negative side effects to stimulants like Adderall that I struggle to deal with, but it's a sacrifice I have made to thrive in this environment. Like eating, for example. I don't know if like you know a lot of kids that take stimulants and never feel hungry, but I've like learned to just eat when I'm supposed to be eating at lunch or whatever, but I don't feel hungry because of the medication, and that never feels good to not feel hungry. And also an inability to sleep as a result of it, and this weird crash that happens where you feel sad after the medication goes away. A weird, immense sad I can't explain, that I had such... with Bernie's my counselor, and I see him every week, and for months we talked about, wow, at 8 p.m., I have this weird, like, depression that forms, and I have nothing... I'm not sad about anything. I just feel so sad and weird, Bernie. What do I do? And we did so many different things to deal with it, and then Slowly, I realized, oh my gosh, this is the Adderall crash. It's a symptom of my medication. I had in it. So I don't know. All these kids that are taking these medicines, they are probably feeling sad when it goes away. And it's something that is unfortunate. And I hope that at some point there's better medication that doesn't have it, because it is detrimental in some ways. But my big point is that it's taken 4 years, but I'm slowly learning that you can think differently and you can be successful. And I know that this is a controversial statement, but I believe that ADHD is environmental, that it's part of my personality, and it's that the system and the environment that is what confines students and makes them feel like they can't be successful. They are equally as successful and probably like more interesting as a result of their quote unquote disability, that in many ways makes them like more valuable members of society or more interesting members of society. So anyways. So I've been like trying different things, because when I started taking it, I secretly was taking it, didn't tell my parents, and it felt like some sort of like dirty thing I was doing. I remember like the first day I took it, I was like feeling like I was like making some big mistake or like we're gonna regret it. So I just would try to take it as little as possible. And I take the fast acting one, and I don't think the fast acting one is very good, actually. And I kind of want to maybe switch and take something that takes the whole day, because I take it in the morning. 4 hours later, I would only took it once at first because I thought it was some bad, dirty thing. So I'd take it in the morning, and then 12 would hit, and I would be so tired and like unable to think, because my ADHD would kick right in. But it has a negative side effect. Now, not only do you have ADHD, so your brain is kind of running, but you're tired. And your brain is not functioning as well. So you can't take Adderall. I personally don't think you can take a tiny dose of Adderall and then the fast acting one and then not take it again a second time, because it will ruin the middle of your day. So I've learned that I have to take my medicine at the same time. I take it at 8. I take it at like 1 or 2 p.m. And I sometimes take another 5 milligrams, a smaller dose, at in the afternoon, because as a college student, I can't just go to bed at 8 p.m. because I'm tired. I have to stay awake and have my brain functioning. So I take 2 10-milligram pills a day now and 1 5-milligram pill in the afternoon if I need to be functioning longer. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know I had ADHD, and I realized that I have been self-advocating my whole life, and I just am lucky that charisma that when Bernie said that, I was like, oh, I guess I've been like working the system for my entire life. Like literally, I have been cheating my way through, and I always felt like I was cheating my way, but it's just the way that I've survived. So when you guys speak about self-advocacy and teaching self-advocacy, I think that's the best thing you can do for kids, because, and my high school taught me that, because we were taught that we had to teach ourselves. So I would go, if I wanted to, like I did a lot of internships, so I had to go speak to people and do research on my own, and that sort of design your own project and do your own thing always taught me self-advocacy techniques, particularly being really honest. So I ask for probably way too many extensions. But I'm just really honest with my professors, and I tell them about my disability, and I'm very transparent about what I'm doing. And I've been lucky to have supportive and respectful professors that respect that is important for me to have extensions. But I immediately, when I got to Bowdoin, was like, oh no, this is bad. Something is very wrong. I cannot do this. And I felt like I wasn't smart enough and that I was just an idiot. I'm a first generation college student. I'm the first to go away. And I kind of got here and was like, I've just made some huge mistakes. Something's like, there's no reason why I'm actually here. This was all a huge mistake. But 4 years later, sort of realizing that, oh no, I think differently, and that's okay.
And my other question is, did internet or gaming get in the way along the line
of when you decide to stop that? Oh, it does get in the way so bad still to this day. And I think maybe meditation is like the only thing that's helped me sort of, like I just started doing crossword puzzles on my phone, which is interesting. So I like try to put my phone away in class. I'm always on my phone in class on accident. I just need to do something with my hands or something. And I like find myself like, I have behavioral problems in class that like lots of kids in elementary school have. They don't go away, but you just sort of like the, I spend hours on essays. I don't procrastinate doing fun stuff. I was telling Bernie, like, I wish I, like, was procrastinating drinking margaritas and dancing, but I'm procrastinating sitting, thinking about how, why the hell am I not writing? Why? Why am I on Facebook? Like, what am I doing with my life? Like, it becomes a little existential crisis. It's a horrible form of procrastination. So I don't know what the solution is. It's, like, very addictive. I don't know.
And do you find that you use things like that to self-medicate and then calm yourself down? I know that's a huge problem for kids with ADHD and just college in general. Do you find that that's harder for you than that you tend to use that?
Yeah, this is probably way too personal, and I don't know if Bernie will approve of this message, so... But yeah, I didn't know that I had ADHD, and I didn't know it. ADHD causes so much anxiety. I was just labeled as an anxious person, and I was labeled as hyper-emotional, and that I had anger problems, and that I was just anxious. That's just who I was. And with meditation, and I do a... Bernie got me into this group called Dialectic Behavioral Therapy that has changed my life. And, like, literally, I will never be the same person after it. It's changed the way that I think, and it's helped me manage my emotions and my impulsivity and helped with my relationships, but it's also helped in the way I think every day and the way that I process my, like, non-judgmentalness that I feel like a lot of kids with ADHD just judge themselves and think that they're just stupid, and the judging just makes the procrastination worse, and then the procrastination makes the anxiety worse, and then you just don't get anything done. And so I smoked weed every day of high school, basically, and didn't really understand why I did that. And I just secretly did a little bit before I went to bed. I didn't do it socially, and I didn't know why I needed it so much, but dialectic behavioral therapy and meditation has taken that away from me. I don't smoke weed anymore at all. I don't feel like I need to because I kind of realized why I was doing it and what was going on. And it definitely came with learning that shutting off your brain, like being able to procrastinate and have fun, is almost impossible for me because I'm stressing so much about school and succeeding. So just being able to manage your emotions and meditation helps so much with that I don't need to do anything like that anymore.
I was just gonna, no, stay. Just one thing, because that's a great question. And if you have patients and they're struggling with anxiety or ADHD, you know, you really ought to check in about their use of marijuana, because most of the students vastly believe that weed will make them feel better. And so it's really hard to say, oh, hold it, no, that isn't true, because they have like the direct evidence of like, I felt really upset, I felt discouraged, I smoked some weed, it kind of helped me survive. So it is really crucial that we like dig in on it, and I think ultimately come up with some alternatives, because I can't really, I mean, you know, and everybody's like, you know, I only smoke organic weed and vape it, and I'm sure that it's all good now, and by the way, it's legalized, so, you know, so you really have to dig in. You know, recently I was talking to a student who was really getting caught in the losing energy, getting tired with anxiety, and in this case, bipolar, just felt like, no, I'm going to smoke this weed, it's going to help me. And it took us a while to, like, say, really? I mean, experiment with that. Do you have a better day? And so we moved it into harm reduction to, like, let's just try it once. at night and see if you can start then to feel better. And by the way, once you're down to once, maybe just try to not put that in your system and see how you feel. So the point is that if you have ADHD patients, probably not when their parents are in the room, you guys know this better than I, but you say like, so how much weed are you smoking? And how does, are you, is that helping? Are you using that regularly? What else do you use? It's mostly, I would say, weed. And you know, some kids will drink, but more often than not, my experience with ADHD is that marijuana helps me, and I will try to use it for that purpose.
Yeah, it is, actually. It's true. Yeah.
How would you, both of you, advise parents, especially teens in high school, as they look at colleges, to sort out a reasonable pick of a supportive environment? Because you're jumping off a cliff.
Yeah.
You jumped and survived.
Almost. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that it was very hard. And I, like, sometimes question if I went to the right place. I think, like, sometimes... I don't know, there's like pros and cons to both, but Bowdoin's so pretentious in many ways, and that it's like made me not, made me feel stupid in many ways, and I'm not, but I felt that way for a long time. But also Bowdoin has so many resources. I got neuropsych testing for free. I would have never been able to afford that. I go to counseling with Bernie at least once a week, and I would have never been able to have that resource in another place. I got dialectic behavioral therapy that's really hard to get into and quite expensive, I realize, when looking at it outside of Bowdoin, for free. Yoga for free. Accommodations and like being able to speak to my professors. So small schools with like lots of resources and guidance, I think, are like, critical. Because I don't know what would have happened if I had been at a big university without this support. I'm not sure.
That is a great question. And I would just say that you guys are key people to helping families and students, you know, consider like how to make an accommodation, how to get situated at a new college or university. And so when I said literally, like, I'll be glad to brainstorm with you at some point if you want to send a family or something. This is a free consultation. What I would say about it, though, is that it makes all the difference. If you're showing up thinking that something is just going to fall into place, it won't. Like, you have to be somewhat mindful as you go into the process about what the school offers, what the student needs, how to get them resources, how to prepare them for this idea that you're going to have to create your own structure. Like, a planner is going to come into your life, and it's got to be your planner, and you've got to work with it. So those things are really helpful, and I'm really pleased to be here talking to you, because I do think you're key people in supporting a family and a student to get to college and university and to be successful. And if they struggle, they ought to call right away, and they'll know within the first wave of papers, tests, assignments, if they are going to get in trouble. The other side of this is that we have kids that will fail out of college. Yeah. Simply, they'll get on academic probation, they'll get sent home, and it's not because they're not capable, it's because they don't really have a plan for how they're going to take these gifts and get them, you know, working for them at college. We could have a whole conversation just about sort of strategies for getting people ready. Yeah, yeah. Or some of you are paying the bills right now, I'm sure. And I just got done paying the bills. So what I would say about that is, in my experience, when I say to students, I think we're going to have a better outcome if we get your family involved, they rarely bat an eye. In fact, I would say this generation is even more so. Like, they look at their parents as like people that they want to, you're looking at me a little bit doubtful about this, but I would say that honestly, 90% of the time, if I say, I think we're going to get so much further down the road if we get your parents connected into this conversation, and then I actually want the parents to hear the neuropsych testing. If you spend the time and money to get a neuropsych test and you don't actually do something with it, it's just a waste of time. So we sit down with the recommendations from the neuropsychologist, with the dean, with the learning center, and with the parents and the student, and we start to plan how to make it. I wouldn't say like we're not like perfect at this. There's a lot of blundering that goes on, and you know, you just try to do your best and you keep hanging in with people. Like I would say that Genevieve had some good success from us in some ways that we didn't maybe help her so much. So, you know, thankfully she stayed in and advocated, but she could have easily left school and thought like there was something wrong with her. And again, this is back to the cultural, bicultural challenge that we have to teach students how to get ready for that when they come. And she goes to another place and she feels like way happier.
No, I didn't go straight to the counseling center. I went to the dean's because I felt like there was something like I had done that was wrong. I was like, I am failing out of freshman year. What do I do? And there, like the system around disability in my 4 years at Bowdoin has rapidly changed for the better. But I had a pretty negative experience with a dean who, he was in charge of way too many things. Like disability was, I don't know, he was in charge of like international students and all the students with disabilities, and he had no specialty in disability. He definitely shouldn't have been doing that, but he kind of was like, they finally let me get neuropsych testing, but it wasn't just like neuropsych testing. I fought for it and I like basically pleaded saying I'm failing and I need help, so help, get me neuropsych testing, and ended up going and seeing Dr. McKim in Portland. And she made me as like part of, and on my, like at the end of my, all of her recommendations, she had so many recommendations to me that were like, kind of like a little Bible of like, oh, what am I gonna do? And one of them was to go to counseling, and it was like a requirement for my accommodation that I start counseling. And that, then I started going to meditation and like somehow nooked my way into Bernie's busy schedule. Because I had a really cool professor that basically like wrote my F on my paper, circled it, and wrote like, come see me immediately, please. And then I went to his office like crying and was like, look at what is going on. I'm failing everything. And he said, I'm not allowed to say this, but I think you have ADHD. I really think you should get neuropsych testing. And he advocated for me. So I had a good professor. Yeah.
I think on the same note, does Bowdoin or other colleges look at students who are failing and direct them to these types of services? Or, you know, you luckily had a professor kind of direct you, but you know, are there systems in place there or other colleges that are doing this already to, it's in their interest to retain students?
Yeah, they helped.
Yeah, no, great point. That really ideally would have been the dean saying, this is interesting, because Bowdoin always says, like, we do all this work to admit you, we know you're smart, so why would we then turn our back and act like, good luck to you, you know? So it should be someone in the, like, the way we notice it is we have this meeting, complex student issues meeting, and when we find a student who's struggling repeatedly, we are like, okay, what are we doing? We're missing something here. So that's when we kind of move into, let's get a little bit more assessment, more service, more support around them. One of the things I do, and as a practitioner, as soon as I hear the word like procrastination, I start going in deeper. Just like, whoa, when did that start? Like, are you saying that happened in grade school or middle school? Or because sometimes people procrastinate from a perfectionism place. Like, you know, I can't write the sentence to make it perfect enough, so I can't go to the second sentence. So that's an anxiety, almost more OCD kind of challenge sometimes. But when someone repeatedly is talking about procrastination, you just have to go in for that because it's creating enormous stress. So that's the way we approach it more on the counseling side. And the deans, mostly at colleges, I think you would expect a deans to step in and help with this. So if you're talking to families about that, families have to make this decision that I think someone was talking about stigma, maybe it's Lois, but you can't, some families don't want to identify that their child has any disability because they worry that the college will start forming impressions and stereotypes and prejudices towards their student, so they don't always want to come in waving that flag. Yet if you don't wave it, and your student is struggling a lot, then they may not get some of the services that could be available to them. So you do have to push in. There are some schools that, like, on their websites, you'll see how ready they are to assist students with learning differences or disabilities. And if a college doesn't say anything about it, you can kind of expect that that's not typically within their bailiwick. It doesn't mean they can't do it. It just means that they're not saying, we recognize that. I mean, same with students of color, first-generation students, underrepresented students. If you go to a college and you're in that category and nobody's talking anything about that, you can be pretty sure that they're not going to be bringing forth what you need potentially to survive and thrive at the school. I mean, this is a generalization, but like, I'm going to rewrite some things on our website to say this is what we do and this is what we don't do, because I don't want parents to come in thinking we can do more than we can either. So you need to be honest about that.
One thing that you said,
that was fantastic, one thing that you said that stood out to me was exercise that you need every day.
Yeah, I used to think it was like second, and my mom, she doesn't understand it really, so she'll always, if I'm stressed out, she'll say like, why don't you just not go on your run today, if like to continue working, you know? And I'm like, no, mom, it's medicine, I need to do it, no. When I went to Chile and I had more free time and I wanted to go see, I like ran around the ocean and I would like leave my house and like just run along the beach and practice running and got better at it because I gave myself the time to do it. And I realized when I came home that I like needed to continue doing it because I feel better. I feel like my brain is so much clearer after it. So I'm now every morning I do it. And Bernie also like has like, he kind of just throws it out, like he kept throwing it out, and so I think when I went to Chile I was thinking about it, and so now I exercise every day and it's necessary. So I don't know if that is what you're thinking?
Yeah,
is that what you're
no, yeah, so it's kinda like a message came from Bernie as well.
Yeah.
I think John Rady is going to really get to that topic really nicely. We've just been given the sign. We are done. Thank you so much.